Some big news about Mike DeWine in the First Energy case. That's what we're talking about first on Today in Ohio. It's the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn here with Lisa Garvin, Layla Tassi, and Laura Johnston. Let's get going on Mike DeWine. We're going to have to start calling the first discussion on this podcast Jake Zuckerman's story time with what he's been on top of lately. Another one, big one on Monday. Laura, how much did First Energy provide secretly to a dark money group supporting Mike DeWine for governor in the months right before the HB6 scandal? And remember, DeWine signed that bill, and he also appointed First Energy darling Sam Randazzo as the state's top utilities guy.
$2.5 million. That's what we're talking about. This is while First Energy was executing what would be the biggest public corruption scheme in the history of Ohio. This $2.5 million was made in secret payments to a dark money nonprofit that backed Mike DeWine's 2018 gubernatorial run. So the payment went to State Solutions. That's a 501c4 nonprofit. It can collect unlimited money to spend on politics. It doesn't have to reveal its contributions. It's funded in part and associated with the Republican Governors Association. And two contributions of $1 million each are listed in First Energy's internal giving list as RGA, Republican Governors Association. A third contribution, $500,000, is listed as DeWine. And the governor's spokesman says he didn't know anything about it. He said that candidates cannot lawfully coordinate with the 501c4 organizations, and said that DeWine has long supported nuclear generation in Ohio, that he had an existing position on the issues, and they wanted to support a candidate who had these positions. But this is on top of a lot of other things that have been piling up about Husted and DeWine.
You know, we keep calling this a $60 million bribery case, but there's so much more money at play in this. And all of these guys say, well, the law doesn't let us coordinate. And they kind of say, we didn't know about it. Why would First Energy give $2.5 million to somebody and not let them know about it? That makes no sense. Of course you want them to know. And First Energy has proven they expected stuff for their money. That's why they bribed $60 million to the householder. It's why they bribed the utilities chief, Sam Randazzo, with $4+ million. This is unbelievable. And what people really have to understand is you would never know about this if there weren't civil lawsuits as fallout in HB6. How many more millions of dollars were poured into dark money funds by all the companies that get freebies from the state legislature? We talk all the time about how this legislature does things that don't serve the residents and that put the interests of the industries first. Well, how much is the oil and gas industry put into dark money funds that we have no idea about? Maybe that would explain why they're fracking under state parks, something that DeWine and the legislature have signed off on. It's defied imagination, right? We keep talking about why would they do it? Well, what if there's millions and millions of dollars there that we don't know about? This is a small window into an enormous problem about state government being bought and paid for.
Absolutely. And we're talking about a six-year-old donation at this point. So you're right. Who knows how many were made before that or how many were made after that? And the whole point is it's called dark money because you can't see into it. We look at campaign contributions every time there's a deadline. They go through the reports. They say who's giving money, who's giving the maximum amount of money. And that's all public. But the dark money can support whoever they want and take whatever kind of money they want. And they never have to tell anyone. It's actually, when you think of it like that, hard to believe that this is legal, and because they are buying politicians and they're telling them what to do. And we have zero ability to see who's pulling the strings behind these politicians. If you want to take this a step further, we talk all about civil discourse and people and gerrymandering and why the legislature is so broken. Talk about the fact that they run for election. They can, whoever raises the most money a lot of times wins. That's why they do this dark money, so they can stay in power, so that they can keep getting reelected.
But let's go back, though. We talked about the nonsensical passage of a bill to stop cities from regulating tobacco, which was being used by kids. It made no sense. And when you look at campaign contributions, they're big, but they're not multi-million dollars like this.
Because they're not legally allowed to be multi-million dollars like that.
So how many millions of dollars have the tobacco companies poured into dark money accounts to buy these guys off? It's the only thing that makes sense. The nursing homes got a big sloppy kiss from the legislature this year after not for some years. Did they finally figure out, oh, we got to put millions into the dark money fund to get more millions from the legislature? And it's all on the backs of us.
Right. And we just talked about the puppy mills, right? That the cities are not allowed since 2016 to pass laws against puppy mills being sold in their towns, which is just very specific, right? I mean, we know that the legislature likes to take away home rule powers from the cities, but this is specifically about dogs. Who's in, you know, who's giving them money behind the scenes? If you look at everything the legislature does, and this has come out in the documents in HB 6, basically, it was telecommunications or something that they were saying they couldn't get what they wanted passed. And the answer was like, well, they didn't give us money. I mean, they're only doing what they're getting paid to do.
Yeah. And but this does, because of this window, because you now see the way the government worked in this case, just this case. Mm-hmm. Look, what First Energy wanted in HB 6 had been denied repeatedly by previous administrations. Kasich wouldn't do it. The legislature wouldn't do it. They then got Householder in. They got DeWine in. And all of a sudden, overnight, there was no discussion. They ramrodded that thing through. That they bought what they wanted. And now we know they put more millions in than we even knew about. So go back now. All of these nonsensical discussions we've had, it now makes sense. This is where the money is. You just can't see it because they've passed laws that allow themselves to get gigantic sums of money to support them that we never see. It is the antithesis of transparency in government. We're supposed to have media watchdogs as part of our government. We've all been blocked from seeing it. This is one of the biggest scandals I've ever seen. What did First Energy expect it would get for the $2.5 million? I can't wait to see more depositions in this from the people that made the decisions to provide that money. What did they think they were getting for it?
Well, and Jake details all the things that DeWine has done for First Energy that we know about. He signed HB 6. That was worth more than $1 billion to First Energy because we're talking about rate increases. We're talking about those nuclear power plant bailouts. He appointed Sam Randazzo. He ignored warnings about Randazzo. People were saying, don't hire him. Don't appoint him. He dispatched, and I forgot this, he dispatched the state plane to deliver legislators to Columbus for a hastily scheduled vote on the bailout.
No, I think in the end, and he didn't send the plane.
Okay. And he hired the First Energy lobbyist as his legislative director in 2010, while the company hired a top DeWine official as a lobbyist.
Oh,
so
I know.
There's just a lot of ties here.
And now we find out there was $2.5 million that went to support him. Shocking story. Well done, Jake. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Lisa, while we're talking about First Energy dark money spending, who else did we find was a beneficiary?
It's our favorite senator, Matt Huffman, possibly. Back in May 2019, a First Energy-controlled 501c4 nonprofit, Partners for Progress, sent five checks totaling $300,000 to another dark money group called Liberty Ohio. Now, Liberty Ohio was referred to in an email from First Energy lobbyist Ty Pine as the Huffman C4. So let's walk through the timeline here. So 2 weeks before the first $50,000 check was sent on May 2019, Highbridge Consulting's Ray Yonkura emailed Pine a PowerPoint overview of Liberty Ohio. That got forwarded to a First Energy lobbyist and then forwarded to Partners for Progress treasurer Michael Van Buren. And Pine was asking, is this what you need on the Huffman C4? One day after the first check was written, a First Energy lobbyist, Mike Dowling, texted CEO Chuck Jones and says, we're going to need C4 infusion. And First Energy lobbyist Danny McCarthy, he said that First Energy lobbyist Danny McCarthy was on his butt about giving to Huffman the next Senate presidents. He wants us to give him a lot because Huffman can get things done. And, you know, Senator Matt Huffman has not been implicated in the HB6 scandal. Let's be clear about that. He said that he never created or controlled a 501c4. And Huffman spokesman John Fortney says that five-year-old emails from campaign operatives and lobbyists is nothing more than hyperbole, big talk, and false assumptions.
Yeah, it's amazing. Everything we've talked about here, this is not how government's supposed to work. It's not representative government. It's not supposed to be based on cash payments. This is as scandalous as anything I've ever seen in the State House. And yet, because there's not media, strong media throughout the state, most Ohioans don't know about it. They know about it in Northeast Ohio because we pound it, and people who read Capital Letter and our other platforms know about it. The people who listen to this podcast know about it. But so much of the state is unaware that their government has just been for sale for years now.
Well, there's another thread here that I want to bring up. Lobbyist Neil Clark, who was implicated and indicted in the HB6 scandal, but killed himself in 2021, he told undercover FBI agents in recorded phone calls that Huffman has his C4 already set up. He's going to be the next Senate president. He has 18 of 24 Republican votes.
You are listening to Today in Ohio. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is not content to let this case play out in regular courts. Layla, why is he before the Ohio Supreme Court about the state's rigid transgender care law?
Well, last week, Franklin County Common Pleas Judge Michael Holbrook put a temporary hold on House Bill 68, which goes into effect on Wednesday and bans minors from obtaining gender-affirming care. The block prevents the state from enforcing it for 14 days or until the judge has another hearing on it, whichever comes first. Holbrook is a Republican, and he was really persuaded by arguments made by the ACLU of Ohio, which is suing over the law on behalf of two 12-year-old transgender girls who are arguing that the law violates four sections of the Ohio Constitution. But Yost on Monday asked the Ohio Supreme Court to review the judge's temporary block. He's saying that the decision affects millions of people across the state rather than just the two people who brought the case. And that means that it's too broad. The block also affects a separate part of the law that bans transgender girls and women in women's sports. And Yost argues that that should be narrowed. And he pointed out that Ohio courts are permitted to grant preliminary injunctive relief only to parties before the court and only as to provisions that allegedly harm them. In a news release, he said, one judge from one county doesn't have the power or does not have more power than the governor's veto pen, which is clearly a reference to Mike DeWine's attempt to veto this law after he spoke with families who said that their kids wouldn't be alive today if not for gender-affirming care. Lawmakers, of course, overrode that veto. So,
but, you know,
we'll wait and
a
see.
Judge does have that power, because when a case is in court, the judge has the power over the case. That's a red herring statement if I ever heard one. Why did he go straight to the Supreme Court? Why didn't he follow proper channels here?
I don't know. I mean, and to your point about that the judge does have that power, I mean, this judge very well could rule that this is completely unconstitutional, and that will apply to the whole state. So, yeah, I'm with you on
that. It's a separation of powers, right? I mean, it would to say,
that's the point.
The judge doesn't have the power over the governor. It's like, yeah, that's why we have three different branches of government. What you're trying to do is kill off one of them, except he's playing, hoping for party politics before the Republicans in the Supreme Court. Otherwise, I mean, go through the process. He's making this an emergency request so he can bypass the normal court procedure. The Supreme Court, if it weren't in the bag, would send it back. Say, no, Attorney General Yost, you know the rules. Go through the proper process here. I think he's reeling because he got caught up so badly last week in being on the wrong side of Biden being on the ballot. I mean, he just was wrong and everybody was howling about his position. I think he's trying to get on firm footing, but this is not the way to do it. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Cleveland State is in trouble. Notre Dame College is closing. Baldwin Wallace is in trouble. Now we have Lakeland Community College in a very tough spot. Laura, what's going on here and what is going on with Ohio higher education institutions overall?
This isn't just an Ohio problem. This is a national problem. And the number of kids going to college has been decreasing across the country since 2010. In Lakeland, it actually peaked in 2012. So it's been dealing with this decrease ever since. And we are going to keep seeing a shakeout of colleges across the country, both private institutions, public institutions. The literature I read, and we're going to be delving a lot deeper into this on Cleveland.com and in the Plain Dealer, is that the most elite institutions are probably going to be fine. They have so many applicants, it's not a big deal to them to see a drop. But for all the rest, there's just too many for the number of kids who want to go to college. And it's not just the number of, you know, the population of that age group, which is a problem. We're going to see a cliff on that soon. But it's also people deciding that college is not worth this incredible cost that you have to take on. You know, we've talked about the rising cost of college for a long time. Now people are looking at that and how long they'd have to pay back those loans and saying, I don't want to do that, even for community college. So right now, Lakeland Community College, which is located in Kirtland in Lake County, has about 5,000 students. That's down from that 9,400 students in 2012. But they haven't made a huge number of reductions since then, which has really hurt their bottom line. They went from a teacher-student ratio of 1 to 21 in 2012 to 1 to 10 now, which sounds great if you're a student, but not if you're trying to pay the bills. They've also undertaken some renovations. They've bought a new building, and they just don't have the money that to seem feasible. The auditor, Keith Faber, says they're headed for a fiscal crisis.
But so many are. I mean, we're seeing it all over the state. And I put a note out on my text account yesterday and got a pretty heavy response from people. I wondered whether the state, DeWine, or somebody could step up and say, let's take an organized approach to what is going to be a reduction in the number of institutions. It's inevitable we're going to have fewer institutions, there aren't enough kids. So instead of having this cutthroat survival of the fittest, would it make more sense for the state, which pays for a lot of higher ed, to kind of manage it? And somebody pointed out that when Strickland was governor, he had Eric Fingerhut put together such a plan, but then John Kasich was elected and he killed the whole thing. This is not going to end well for anybody. They're all scraping. Why not think about some mergers? Do we need a Kent State University and an Akron University, or do we need a CSU and an Akron? They both have law schools. Could we get by with a single law school? You know, should there be an Ohio State University system like the SUNY system in New York, where you have Ohio State University at Cleveland and Ohio State University at wherever? And then start culling these schools so that you can be robust, because otherwise it's going to be death by a thousand cuts across the state, and they're all going to get weaker.
And I think cities that host these, like South Euclid, which is losing Notre Dame pretty quickly, cities have to be proactive in thinking that this could happen to their campuses that they host as well, and figure out what to do and you know, how to head it off if they can, or what to do if they can't.
Yeah, if John Carroll closed, would University Heights have to change their name?
Right.
I agree with you, Chris, that there needs to be a deep look at the programs being offered. I don't know how well an OSU branch campus system would go over. The thing is, there's already OSUs all over the place. There's one in Worcester. If you're a freshman and you're not in the honors program, it's really difficult to even go to the main campus at
this
point.
Okay, but... All right, so it's not OSU, but there's got to be some way to look at this and say, we want each region served. What can we do?
Well, instead of Jerry Sereno calling in college presidents to lecture them about American history, maybe this is what the state should be doing and figuring out how to help them, because we've talked again, they don't give as much money as they used to these state schools. We are not supporting them with our taxes as much as we used to.
No, because we're giving it all to the industries that are paying dark money and buying off the legislature.
And private K-12 schools.
Yeah, the vouchers. The reason I think they don't do it is because if you do that, you're picking winners and losers. And as we're seeing with Notre Dame, every school that gets shuttered has a big alumni association that's furious, and that hurts your support politically. But to leave these schools to just go at each other, this is ugly. I don't see how Lakeland continues. They're in big trouble. This is one of the worst audits we've ever seen. But we're just at the beginning. Wittenberg is another one somebody sent me. We've talked about Baldwin Wallace's problems. Is any school other than the gigantic ones robust?
And these are different categories, right? Like Wittenberg, Baldwin Wallace, Notre Dame, those are all private independent institutions. Findlay and Bluffton are merging. We haven't written about that. It's a Northwest Ohio. And then there's a separate issue of the state-supported public schools and the community colleges. These are, I mean, they all have similar problems, but there's probably going to be different solutions. The state can't make the private schools do anything, but they definitely have some power over the public universities.
Well, power and the ability to provide some aid. It's just, right. This is right now helter-skelter, and we've known it was coming for more than a decade. All of these demographic predictions came because they could see how many kids were born, that this was going to happen. And it feels like we're totally unprepared.
But COVID really did fast forward it a lot, I think. And a lot more kids are going to school online, so you don't need the same kind of infrastructure.
All right. We'll be talking about this for a long time to come. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Anyone who has dealt with a senior citizen who is having issues with the Social Security office knows what a hardship this next story could be. Lisa, why is the Social Security office in Warrensville Heights closing for 90 days and maybe longer?
Well, the reason is high staff attrition. They just don't have the staff. So the Warrensville Heights Office of Social Security will be closing for 90 days starting in May. They'll be taking phone appointments and in-person appointments for only limited or critical situations until May 8th. There is no comment on when or if this office will reopen. American Federation of Government Employees Local 3448 head Michael Murphy says Social Security Administration staffing nationwide is at its lowest since 2011. Warrensville Heights is far from alone. Many experienced workers retired during the pandemic. What he would like to see is the Warrensville Heights office become a training center for new employees. They lost a lot of institutional knowledge with these retirements, and he'd like more money to hire Social Security staff. They are desperate for people. They've been forced to shortchange their training, so more mistakes get made, and offices are consolidating. But Senator Sherrod Brown and Representative Chantel Brown, who represents Warrensville Heights, are asking the Social Security Commission to take the steps needed to reopen the Warrensville Heights office. They say it's a major issue for their constituents.
I'm surprised that this is an office that has a hard time finding workers, because these are federal jobs that has a great pension, and generally federal salaries are pretty good. But I wonder if the Social Security Administration doesn't pay well for this kind of work. It's tedious work and you're dealing with a lot of upset people, but it's one of the few jobs left where you get a pension that takes care of you deep into your retirement years. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Remember Tamia Chapman, the 13-year-old girl who was walking to the library in East Cleveland when she was killed by a car speeding from police in a chase? Nearly 5 years later, Layla, how has the family's lawsuit over this tragedy been resolved?
Tamia's family agreed to settle their lawsuit against Cleveland for $4.8 million. Tamia was killed in 2019 after a 15-year-old suspect in a high-speed chase careened off the road and struck her. That chase reached speeds of more than 80 miles per hour, and it ended on Euclid Avenue. This is one of the largest settlements in Ohio involving a police chase. In 2014, Cleveland paid $3 million to the families of Melissa Williams and Timothy Russell, who were involved in that 2012 pursuit that ended when police fired 137 bullets into the car that they were in. Stanley Jackson, the attorney for Tamia's family, told reporters that in Tamia's case, the police didn't follow their own pursuit policies. They operated with no common sense, and supervisors failed their duties too, letting this chase reach those high speeds on residential streets. And a city spokesman pointed out that the chase began with the carjacking of a 72-year-old woman outside a grocery store. And he put the blame for Tamia's death on the suspects who chose to flee from police that day.
The sad thing about this was, for the longest part of this, it wasn't a high-speed chase. These guys were involved in a carjacking at a Target on the west side. Police got behind them, but they didn't know they were there, and they were tracking their movements. But then, after a long way to the east side, they picked up on that they were being followed and gunned it. And that's when everything went south. This is one of the saddest stories. Laura, I think you were in the newsroom when this was breaking and were overseeing the coverage, weren't you?
Yes, it was right before Christmas.
Right.
And I remember that it really clearly, because it was, I think, a Friday night. And it was one of those things like you're just wrapping up and this horrible thing happened. And it was an all hands on deck kind of moment in the newsroom, but it's so sad. We call a lot of things tragedies, but this one really hits you.
Yeah, she's just walking from school to the library like any kid would and ended. It's very sad. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We need to tie up the case, Akron sure seems like a city in need of a federal consent decree. How has it made the optics even worse in the case of the 13-year-old who was playing with a toy gun and was shot by police?
This is awful. Tavion Koontz-Williams is 15 years old. He was shot by police. Thank God he's mostly okay as far as I know. He's shot in the hand. But he's now charged with possessing a facsimile firearm. This is a first-degree misdemeanor. He was charged on Friday. If you remember, he was shot on Britton Road in Akron's Goodyear Heights neighborhood on April 1st. A woman had called police, said a black youth was pointing a gun at houses in the neighborhood. A lot of similarities here that jump out at you with Tamir Rice. The officer was Ryan Westlake, a 9-year police veteran who has a spotty history with the department. In the body cam footage, he asked the teenager to show his hand, then shot him within seconds. And the family is obviously outraged, and you so feel for them. The lawyer said, it is not a crime to have a toy gun. It is not a crime to be a 15-year-old playing with toys. It is not a crime to be a black kid in Akron, Ohio, doing what kids do.
Yeah, well, they're right about this. You're allowed to have a gun. Ohio has pretty much cleared the decks. I don't get how they can charge him. And what does it say? I mean, clearly, you don't want to shoot this kid. Clearly, this cop operated way too fast, and Akron has some explaining to do. But to turn around and hit him with charges, it's unbelievable. This police department is out of control. We've talked about it repeatedly. They keep getting involved in really bad stuff in a way Cleveland used to before its consent decree. The Justice Department needs to come in and land on them. I can't believe the new mayor there is allowing this to happen.
And the new mayor, we were giving him accolades saying, you know, he responded very quickly. They put out all of the body cam. They released the name and the personnel file of this officer. Because if you remember last summer, that took weeks. Was it last summer? 2 summers ago? 2 summers. That took weeks to get when that young black man was shot after the chase. And so it felt like things were turning around a little bit. But no, it's really disappointing to see.
This could result in a massive protest. I mean, it's just, you don't do this. The kid, they're lucky he didn't die. But to turn around, when that one dropped, you're thinking, they can't be that stupid, can they? But clearly they are.
Are they thinking? You just want to know, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, it's a shock. And I don't think it ends here. I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't see a huge protest come out of this, because this is not the answer for what happened in that case.
And they're asking for a firing of this officer who's now on paid administrative leave, which you just are like, well, he's getting paid while he's being checked out. Meanwhile, this kid's getting slapped with a misdemeanor charge. And yeah, there was a lot of protest after Jaylen Walker. I would not be surprised to see this happening again.
Because it's so outrageous. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We do need to tie up the case in which a Cleveland Heights tattoo artist sued a video game company for showing LeBron James tattoos without permission from the artist. Lisa, what was the verdict?
On Friday, the jury ruled in favor of Take-Two Interactive, the makers of the NBA 2K video game. This was a lawsuit that was filed by Cleveland Heights tattoo artist Jimmy Hayden, who alleged that use of 2 LeBron tattoos that he did on LeBron's game avatar was a copyright infringement. The jury took only 90 minutes to reach their verdict. They found that there was no infringement. They found that Hayden and LeBron had an implied license that allowed LeBron to license his likeness, including his tattoos. And LeBron did side with Take-Two in a tape deposition that was played during the trial. He says he didn't know he needed permission. And furthermore, no one should have rights over what I do with my body. Hayden's attorney, Todd Tucker, had no comment after the trial, but during arguments during the trial, he said it was straightforward copyright infringement. Why did Take-Two fight so hard against a small business owner when they paid millions in other licensing rights, including music used in the game?
Yeah, I kind of didn't think the tattoo artist should win this one. It did seem like they were pushing too far, so the right thing seemed to happen. I wasn't sure because the copyright law is bizarre. We deal with it all the time. But it seems like this is the right verdict, right?
Well, and the Take-Two lawyers argued, they said, you know, this could have a chilling effect on people getting tattoos. If they feel like their tattoos are copyrighted and they can't use them the way they feel, that could keep people from getting tattoos. So it would kind of be self-harming their industry.
Well, I doubt that when people get tattoos, that they're signing a rights agreement each time. Because if they go shirtless or wear a short sleeve shirt, the tattoos are visible to everybody. It just seems like this is crossing the line of common sense. If you are a tattoo artist and you put a tattoo on somebody, you're allowing them to be seen in wherever they're seen, which is what the verdict ended up finding. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We're wrapping up for a Tuesday. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Laura. Thank you for listening. Come back Wednesday for another discussion of the news.